KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. This fall, President Obama will choose somebody to run the Federal Reserve. Why should you care? We'll find out more just after 10 o'clock. Coming up later this hour, Pacific Northwest Ballet Artistic Director Peter Bowl. A new report shows Washington State has the seventh highest vaccination opt-out rate in the country. More than 4% of incoming kindergartners don't get basic childhood immunizations, and that's an improvement over the 2008-2009 school year when Washington had the highest opt-out rate in the country. Why do so many Washington families decide not to get their kids immunized, and how do health officials deal with this? Jeffrey Duchin joins us now. He's Chief of Epidemiology and Immunization at King County Public Health. Good morning.
Good morning.
Why are public health officials concerned when families decide that they won't get their kids vaccinated?
Yeah, that great question. First, let me just clarify that when we talk about kids being exempted from vaccines or not getting their kids vaccinated, that figure that you mentioned, about 4.5%, represents kids who've had one or more vaccines that they decided they didn't get. So it doesn't necessarily mean that these children are completely unvaccinated. And in fact, most of them have received many vaccines, but they may have elected, the parents may have elected to not vaccinate the child with one or more vaccines. The reason that's important to us is because for certain diseases in particular, like measles, we need to maintain very high vaccination coverage to prevent outbreaks. We know, and there have been many described even from our neighbors in Canada and spots in the U.S., that a disease like measles, which transmits so efficiently from person to person, can cause outbreaks even when vaccination rates are in the high 80s and low 90s. And our overall percentage for the state, 4.5%, really is a conglomeration of all the different school districts in the state, because they're the ones who report. And that varies widely. In some smaller, particularly school districts, in some areas, even in King County, the vaccination rates are significantly higher than 4.5%. And then in others, I should say the exemption rates,
right.
And in others, they're significantly lower. So what we're really concerned about are those pockets where we have higher numbers of kids who may be susceptible to certain diseases that can really transmit readily from person to person in the school setting and attack kids who are, you know, vulnerable to severe disease, even if perhaps they would want to be immunized but can't for some underlying disease or real contraindication.
What are the frequently cited reasons that a parent or a family would request an exemption?
Well, there are, you know, a number of reasons, and it varies widely depending on what community you're talking about. But things that people have objected to are concerns about autism, which has been completely and totally debunked, although the belief persists that vaccines are somehow related to autism, particularly the MMR vaccine. Study after study has debunked that. The original theory was promoted by a quack researcher who's been stripped of his credentials and no longer able to practice medicine, but that still, you know, persists. There are other concerns that parents have about the number of immunizations that a child receives, thinking that there's some health risk because there's too many vaccines being given in too short a time frame. There's mistrust of government, mistrust of pharmaceutical industry, and there's also some who believe that just natural disease is better than, you know, vaccinations. I'd rather have my kid get the real thing than be vaccinated.
A 2000 state law makes it a little more complicated for families to get those personal exemptions. You have to have a signed letter from a physician, et cetera. Did that cause the opt-out rate to decrease?
Well, we don't really know. The opt-out rate peaked statewide in 2008-09 school year, and then it dropped for 2 years consecutively. And then in 2011, after 2 years of dropping, the exemption law went into effect, which requires that parents be educated about the pros and cons of vaccination before they make that decision of whether or not they're going to have their child skip a vaccine. And since that time, it dropped again by another, you know, approximately 1.5 percentage points. There are a number of reasons why it could have dropped, and we're thinking that the exemption law had some effect. It may or may not be related to fewer kids being exempted, because it was quite possible that before the law went into effect, some parents just claimed exemption in order to avoid having to produce the documentation of immunization, so that kids who were actually vaccinated were being identified as being exempt and recorded as exempt, even though they were vaccinated. So it's really a little bit unclear as to the exact reason why the rates are falling, although it's a very good thing that the rates are falling for whatever reason.
Well, so the rates are falling, but Washington still has the seventh highest opt-out rate in the country. What are particular challenges here?
Yeah, I think Washington and New England and California, West Coast, Oregon, have similar challenges in that there are communities that have different belief systems regarding immunization that can vary. As I mentioned, you know, there are issues around vaccine safety that some people are hesitant about. There are issues around mistrust of government and mistrust of pharmaceutical companies that make vaccines, belief in natural lifestyle. So one of the challenges is that this isn't just a single problem where you could identify the problem and address all concerned parents with the same issues. Another challenge is that we know from research that it's the relationship between the child's health care provider and the family that's the most important determinant in whether or not a child gets vaccinated. And so keeping the importance of immunizations and talking to families and taking the time to understand their concerns and counsel them about the value of immunizations, keeping that front and center on healthcare providers' radar is a challenge, because healthcare providers have a whole lot of priorities that they're trying to juggle in their daily routine, seeing patients for all different types of reasons, but not missing opportunities to discuss with families and make strong recommendations for vaccinations and let people know why they're so important is another challenge. It's something that requires a lot of time and energy, basically, and constant work. It's not something that can be done once with a PR campaign and then you're there for the rest of the decade. Or it's every day. You know, this requires work.
Will it help when there's greater healthcare coverage?
Well, we don't believe that lack of access to health care is a major determinant of immunization coverage at this point. And I should also point out that, you know, for all of our required childhood vaccines in Washington State, we're over 90% coverage. So that means that our children, over 90% of children, have received each of the required vaccines. The exemption rate, you know, doesn't correlate exactly with how many children are actually vaccinated or not. There are other reasons and other problems that can cause children not to be vaccinated. For example, in Washington State, although we have 4.5% of our children who are not vaccinated for one or more vaccine, we also have almost 8% who are out of compliance with vaccination for reasons other than exemption. Hmm. And that can be that, you know, the family, as you say, you know, maybe didn't get the kid in on time for his vaccinations, or rare instances where they may not have access to health care. And we're hoping that with the Affordable Care Act and more people coming on board, you know, all children will have easy access. Most children in Washington State, because we do have a universal immunization program now, have access to vaccines at no cost. So as long as they're hooked into a pediatrician or a family practice doc, a healthcare provider, they don't have to pay for their vaccines. But there are probably some families out there who just aren't linked into the healthcare system at all, and we're hoping that will change as we get more families aware of the benefits that are offered by the Affordable Care Act, which include immunizations as well as other important preventive health measures.
Jeffrey Duchin, thank you for speaking with us this morning.
Thanks for having me on.
Jeffrey Duchin is Chief of Epidemiology and Immunization at King County Public Health. This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
It's 916 KUW 94.9 News and Information. Everything you ever wanted to know about karaoke, this afternoon at 1240.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Cancer Care Alliance Proton Therapy, a ProCure center. At SCCA Proton Therapy, doctors treat prostate cancer and certain other cancers by precisely targeting tumors while minimizing effects on surrounding tissue. More at SCCAProtonTherapy.com.
70 degrees in Seattle, expecting a high today in the mid-70s. Mostly cloudy this afternoon, a 40% chance of rain. Tonight's low temperature around 60, mostly cloudy, a 30% chance of showers tonight.
From KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. What does it mean to be devoted? The word devotion is often used in a religious or spiritual context, but Seattle writer and artist Rebecca Brown takes a broader view in a new show that she's curated at Seattle University's Hadrian Gallery. The show is called, well, what else? It's called Devotion, and Rebecca Brown joins me now. It's great to have you in here.
It's great to be back, Marcy. Thanks.
I don't associate you with curation as being a curator. Is that something that you do?
Well, curation of visual arts is new to me, but this term curating has been around in the literary arts. We've also had literary curators for a number of years, and I've certainly, for the last 15 years, curated reading series, inviting writers, musicians, artists in different venues. But this is the first time that the sort of lead art was visual art.
And how did you get involved in this show?
The Hadrian Gallery on Seattle U campus is a fairly recent addition to the campus. And they've been bringing in different curators to work for, a year or so each, and to sort of bring different voices to the gallery. The current curator at the Hadrian is Amanda Manatek, who's both a visual artist and an art critic. She writes for City Arts, does video work. So she's a very interdisciplinary thinker and art maker. And she invited me to have a show at the gallery. And I my visual art is could probably fit on this table. And I said, I certainly can't fill a gallery for a month, but I'd love to curate something. So she basically said, think of something and we'll talk about it. And I came up with this theme, devotion.
How?
It's for me, certainly in my own art, but also in my curation, it's in some ways it's always ultimately kind of self-serving. For the last few years, I've been furrowing my brow over questions of devotion, of spirituality or religion or faith. And I thought, and so I've been engaged in conversations for a number of years, but in particular in the last two or three years with friends and artistic colleagues and religious folks about God and spirituality. So I thought, what an opportunity to spend more time with friends and artists and ask them to make something that expresses something about their devotion.
But this isn't necessarily limited to somebody's spirituality or religious practice.
Not at all. No, the Hadrian is, Seattle U is a Jesuit university, sure. And the Hadrian is very much about engaging with the whole world. And so when I thought of devotion, the obvious definition is a sort of religious devotion. But when I think of devotion as a way someone spends his or her time, or something that someone values or that gives their life purpose or a sense of something bigger. When I looked around, other people are devoted to other things. Mm-hmm. And the curious thing for me was when I asked, I would say half the people showing work in the gallery are not and do not think of themselves as visual artists. But when I asked people, are you devoted to something? Most people were like, oh, no, I'm not religious. But then over the course of the conversation, be like, well, where do you spend your time? What's interesting to you? So, blah, blah, blah. And very sort of self-deprecating or dismissive, but like that's what's important is something you're too shy to talk about in public.
Well, it's interesting because what has popped into my head every time I've been thinking about talking with you is some horrible it's a great song in its context. Hopelessly Devoted to You, which is a song from Greece, I think.
You know, this song has been mentioned to me numerous times, and I confess it's not a song I am devoted to.
Yeah, I'm not devoted to it. When I hear that word, that's a devotion to another person, a love interest or worshiping something.
Yeah.
But that word worship is also used in the context of romantic love and devotion as well.
I think there's something about romantic love, the sort of eros being swept up in something that you can't reason with or understand, but that ultimately should make your life bigger and connect you more to the world, has something aligned with devotion. I think that the dangerous thing is a sort of extreme past devotion, which you can call obsession, which one of our speakers who will be speaking next week, August 22nd at 7, Father John Whitney, talks about obsession and devotion, and how the one is not the other, that devotion makes one bigger and obsession makes one smaller, essentially.
Does he see it as a progression? Can devotion turn into obsession?
I don't think it's necessarily progression. I mean, just before, when I was sitting in the green room listening and the stories about Egypt, now more than 500 people have been killed. And so I'm thinking, are these people, I'm sure at some point these people engaging in violence have been or are devoted to some belief in national identity or some kind of cause. But when does devotion to something that would be expansive and whole-making turn into something that is destructive of others? And that's a tricky one. But the folks in the gallery show are not obsessives. They're they're devoted to collecting sportswear, vintage sportswear, like our 14-year-old contributor Skylar Brace's, or whether they're devoted to playing music for people in bars like DJ Riz is. The something about the devotion is an engagement with the material.
Mm-hmm.
In order to make their community and themselves bigger.
We're talking with Rebecca Brown. She's a writer, an artist, and now a curator of a visual art show called Devotion at Seattle University's Hadrian Gallery. And this is a little, indulge me here, a little bit of a sideways curve, but you attended the first cycle, the Ring Cycle, time seeing a four-opera cycle to which many people are passionately devoted. And you probably saw some of them in the audience. And I bring that to you because passion is something that I think is part of devotion, isn't it?
I think so, too, in a big way. Yeah, I was very, very fortunate that I was able to see the entire Ring Cycle last week for the first time in my life. It's something my wife, Chris, and I just couldn't believe we got the opportunity to do. And I also blogged about it for Stranger Slog. And in my last entry on the slog, I talked about spending that week with Wagner. It's an exercise in complete absorption in excess. And there's something about being devoted with another with a group of people, right? It helps you lose your identity even more, particularly in arts or church, but a place that you're in a darkened room with a lot of people doing the same thing you think is important, that has an element of mystery to it. So the Ring really got to me in that way. But I do have to say, Marcy, I was disappointed that I have seen a number of individual Wagner operas, and the one time I went to one piece of the Ring Cycle a number of years ago, I did see a large man in his 50s in a pair of lederhosen. And I did not see that this year. I was slightly disappointed, but everything else was great.
You can come and hang out for the other two cycles. What are you personally devoted to?
Oh, dear. Here's the difficult part. I'm much more comfortable asking other people about their devotion and encouraging them to express their devotion. I wrote an essay that goes in our little catalog. I've given you a copy of about devotion, preparing for this lecture. And for a long time, I had this during the course of writing the essay, had an idea that I my devotion is to words, and I'm very obsessed is the word. Interested in how words work and their histories and meanings, but over the course of recent conversations with a couple of the folks in the exhibit, I happened to mention to someone that I go to daily mass. And my friend's eyes lit up. She said, "You go to church every day?" And I said, "Well, I go to mass every day." And she said, "That's what you're devoted to. And I was like, yeah, but I'm not going to talk about that. And at the same time, I've asked these other people to talk about things that they do that is important to them that's not necessarily art.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this very nervous, shy-making, do I want to make the private public? And on the other hand, yes, we want to open a conversation and not be closeted about how we love, which is a phrase that goes back to my political history.
Yeah. Well, you can see more throughout the course of this show, Devotion, which is open now at Hadrian Gallery, which is on the eastern edge of the Seattle University campus, and I believe it's up for a month.
Yeah, our closing event is August 29th both tonight and the 22nd, the 29th. Thursday nights at 7, we'll be having readings, music, et cetera. We'll also have an event on the 26th, Monday at 7, with Nancy Kiefer, a visual artist in the show, and with Jessica Obrist, who is a nerdlesque dancer. So she'll be talking about burlesque as a devotional practice. Tonight, I'll be reading Mike Cattell, composer, musician, will be playing music, and Susie Lee, visual artist. And next week, Father John Whitney and Riz Rollins.
Very good memory and a chance to talk about devotion in the gallery itself.
Right. Rebecca, it's a great question to ask your friends. What are you devoted to?
Rebecca, thanks for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Marcy. Thanks a lot.
This is KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman.
KUOW 94.9 News and Information. Growing up, Julia Child never cooked a thing. We'll hear the story of how she gradually, over many years, made her way into the kitchen. That's today at 2:55.
What's going on in your brain while you sleep, and how can you make sure you get the sleep you need? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with neuroscientist Penelope Lewis, author of The Secret World of Sleep. She runs the Sleep and Memory Lab at the University of Manchester in England. Join us.
You can hear that tonight at 8 o'clock on our second program service, KUOW2.
KUOW and Shack Art Center present Fresh Paint, Festival of Artists, at Work at the Everett Marina on August 17th and 18th. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
70 degrees in Seattle. Today's projected high in the mid-70s. Mostly cloudy this afternoon with a 40% chance of rain. Tonight's low around 60, mostly cloudy with a 30% chance of showers.
From KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. Over the past decade, Seattle's major arts groups have all seen a sort of changing of the guard at the top. Ludovic Morlot's come on as music director at Seattle Symphony. Seattle Opera just this summer announced that Aidan Lang would replace longtime general director Spate Jenkins. Kimberly Rorschach is Seattle Art Museum's new director. And the granddaddy of this new generation, if you can call him that, is Pacific Northwest Ballet artistic director Peter Boll. Peter Boll and ballet were a couple long before he took the job at PNB in 2005. He was a dancer with New York City Ballet from 1983 until he retired 22 years later. He brought that experience and a whole lot more with him to Seattle. And Peter, you must like it here because you renewed your contract and you're going to stay in Seattle for a while longer.
Yeah, I actually love it here. I love this company, this city, just about everything there is here.
You and I have spoken a lot over the years since you came here, but I'm not sure you've ever been to the KUOW studios.
So I haven't.
I'm delighted to have you here. And I have to ask you first, this popped up in my head this morning when I was brushing my teeth, that people hear that word ballet, and I think everybody has their own individual image. What does that word mean to you, ballet?
Yeah, it's interesting because the word has such a long history, and I think immediately people think of something that another generation might have appreciated. It was something for their grandparents or their parents, and is there something for me in ballet? Is it relevant to today's generations? I think one of the most exciting things about PNB right now is that our teenage audience is booming. I see it as a huge sign of success that they see a relevancy for them in what we're doing.
I think it was your first season here, one of the first seasons that you were here. You put a dance on stage that you're reprising this season, I believe. It was an aerial ballet, I'm not sure, maybe it was 7 minutes long, called The Kiss by Susan Marshall, a dance that should have gone on a lot longer in my mind. So you'd leave them wanting more. And people in the audience were sort of shrieking in glee. I don't know what other word to say. It seemed like this was something that stopped everybody in the audience in their tracks and in their definition of what could be seen on this giant Macaw Hall stage.
Yeah, I love that notion, especially when I arrive, that the curtain will go up and you don't necessarily know what you're going to see. The fascinating thing about Kiss is it's two dancers, a male and a female, suspended from 40-foot-long ropes. And they're in harnesses and their feet touch the floor. There's no real element of danger. But when they run, of course, then they're airborne for moments until they swing back to the floor. And it is 7 minutes. It's Arvo Pärt's music. And there's something very hypnotic about it. But I think the reason that people were taken aback by it, because was it ballet? The dancers were in white t-shirts and jeans. The movement wasn't especially balletic. There weren't necessarily pointed toes. There certainly weren't tutus, no tiaras. And it was very human. It was about two beings. It didn't even have to be a male and a female, but the beauty of the connection with the kiss. And you felt like you were watching something that was just beyond any art form and connected so directly to members of the audience.
So when you're picking dances to present to this audience in Seattle, there have been dances that are a whole lot wilder than that that have been on the stage during your tenure. And I know that there have been letters to the editor condemning some of the things that you've presented. And yet you can present George Balanchine's Midsummer Night's Dream with all the tutus and glitter and flowery little things that any traditional ballet lover could want. So what are you thinking about when somebody says pick a season, pick something to present to Seattle?
Well, I find the variety essential. I just want to sort of keep pushing the envelope in both directions. You know, reviving a production of Giselle, and we're building new sets and costumes for this coming season. And the designer said, well, which direction do you want to go? Do you want to push the edge with contemporary sets and costumes, which I've seen work well? But I want to go as ultra classical and as timely as possible and just sort of have that exquisite sense of tradition. And then at the other end, there's some very contemporary pieces, not all of which have been successful. But I think at the end of the day, our audiences appreciate that this new material is brought to them. Some of them will, you know, they'll meet me in the post-performance Q&A and say, I didn't like it. Can you tell me why you wanted to program it? Why do you like it? What do you see in it? And we'll talk through it. And some of them come back again and say, okay, I got it. I still don't like it, but I'm glad I saw it twice.
I mentioned in introducing you that you became a professional dancer in 1983. You started dancing earlier than that. You had this long career as a dancer. You taught at the School for American Ballet, which is affiliated with New York City Ballet. And you had your own little company, much smaller than PNB, before you came here. But what qualified you to, I'm sorry, but what qualified you to take over the reins from Kent Stoll and Francia Russell?
Yes, it's a very strange process finding artistic directors for ballet companies. Every now and then there's somebody who's proven themselves as an artistic director coming in. So often there's this leap of faith where you meet somebody. I mean, I had this tiny sliver of experience as an artistic director, having founded a company called Peter Bowl & Company in New York. Over the course of 2 years, we did maybe 25 performances, and the biggest we were was four dancers. I mean, we were working with Twyla Tharp and William Forsythe and Marco Gecka. And
those are all choreographers, contemporary choreographers.
Yeah, so there was an energy of the new, but it really was nothing on the scale of Pacific Northwest Ballet. So I think it's a lot reputation in the dance world. It's a lot of trust. It was an enormous leap of faith for the Seattle community, and hopefully there are no regrets at this point.
I guess not, since they offered you a contract extension. We're talking with Peter Bowl, who's artistic director of Pacific Northwest Ballet, and I think you're going into your ninth season.
That's correct.
With the company. So that's a long time. And when one of the early conversations I had with you, you told me that one of your goals was to expand a body of work by several choreographers that weren't as familiar to the ballet audience as George Balanchine is here. And so I'm naming three that I could think of off the top of my head. Jerome Robbins, who worked with New York City Ballet, who you worked with in New York. Christopher Wheeldon, who is a younger choreographer. I'm not actually sure how old he is. And then the first artist in residence under your tenure, Twyla Tharp. Has PNB ever had an artist in residence before?
Not that I know of. I think this is the first time. And one of the things that I admired about Twyla, we have a pretty strong relationship over the last 6 or 7 years. But she tends to affect every part of the institution. In this case, she's wanting a set design for this new work that'll premiere in September. And so the scenic shop is working with her on that. There's costume designs for the original costumes. She tends to work with the marketing department on what will work best as far as a poster image. And I feel we did some work with the school. They did a work of hers a few months ago. And I think broadly, she can have an effect on the entire institution that's positive and beneficial for everybody at PNB.
So when it's artist in residence, she hasn't been here throughout a consecutive series of calendar months, has she?
No, it's more that her work is spanning the course of a year. It was about a year ago that we took an all-Tharp program to the Spoleto Festival in Italy, which was a first for us. And then she was here working on In the Upper Room last March and also creating new material for this premiere that happens in September. So she spent 2 weeks with us in March, and then she's spending 6 weeks with us. She arrives this weekend to start refocusing on the all-Tharp program.
You have several living choreographers bringing their work to Seattle this season, as you do most seasons. How does that affect the company itself, the dancers? They have a very, for people who don't know this, dancers work all day, every day. They don't just come in, put on their costumes and dance on the weekends. They spend several hours in the morning in a rigorous class, and then they kind of rehearse all day, and they eat. It's a lie that most of them don't eat. In Seattle, they eat a lot of food, which is good because they burn it off. But how does it affect them when there's somebody making new work in their midst?
Well, it's intense. I mean, because you're really out there. You're the clay. You're the paint. You're also the brain that's being interacted with. But I thought it was one of the greatest parts of the profession. You mentioned Jerome Robbins, and I got to go in the studio 6 times with him to work on original ballets and create new material. Same thing with Twyla Tharp. But for this, we just had Crystal Pite, who's one of the choreographers that I'm most excited about working today, and a young Spanish choreographer that's based with Hubbard Street, Alejandro Cerudo, who is also making original material. And the dancers, everybody wants to be in it. Everybody wants to be available and devote themselves to it. And also you feel so much a part of the process. I always went in the studio thinking this could be an Agon, which was one of the great works by George Balanchine. But every time there's that blank canvas and there's something about that first brushstroke and to be there and to be a part of that, I think it's the most rewarding thing that you can do as a dancer.
Do you miss dancing?
Every day I do.
Could you step back into it if you wanted to?
If there were no audience, sure. No, I actually love getting out there in a few character roles. But, you know at the beginning that you sort of have this time span. And if you want to do it with pride, it ends at some point.
You have to leave at the top of your game?
Yes, you do.
What's been the biggest challenge in this tenure in Seattle?
I actually think the coming into the job, there was sort of a first year that was wonderful where I felt really embraced by Seattle and by our audience and by our dancers and by all of PNB. And then it changed a little bit, I think, as it does with any transition. There were dancers that sort of enjoyed that honeymoon period, and then there was some underlying anger at PNB that was difficult for me to deal with, and I think a misunderstanding of who I was and what my motives were and maybe what I was trying to accomplish as far as casting or repertory. And there was a little bit of a backlash, which was hard to move through. At the end of the day, it brought about great discussions where dancers realized maybe this wasn't the place for them, or maybe I realized it wasn't the place for them. And that was actually it was really like a bit of a quiet earthquake running through the company. And it stayed quiet. It wasn't publicly known.
You, during this 40th anniversary season that ended officially in June, You took the company, as you mentioned, to Spoleto in Italy. The company has been to the East Coast. They were at the New York, sort of a big glittering premiere in the house that Balanchine built. And I believe less than a month ago, they returned from Vail, Colorado. So they've gone places, and you've had a chance to see your dancers up against companies from all over the world. And I mean, this is an unfair question. You're going to say wonderful things. They're your dancers. But where do you rate PNB at this point as technically, artistically?
Well, the dancers, you're right, they are on such a par, and they really are with any dancer in this country and probably the world. They're right up there. You know, they trained alongside the principal dancers of American Ballet Theatre, San Francisco Ballet, and New York City Ballet. They were in the same classes. They might have missed that cut when there were only two contracts available for this country and the company, and they were the third. But I think one of the things about Pacific Northwest Ballet that's unique is that they are wholly devoted to what they do. They're not in it for selfish reasons. They understand the broader scope of the company. This group is amazing, the way that they are committed to the mission of the company. It's not about gaining an individual spotlight, but it's about serving the institution and ultimately the art form. And I think that's what really makes us unique, and you feel that on the stage.
So, Peter, as you and I are talking about something that we both like, and it's, I will make no secret, I attend almost every program that you present and have since you've come here. Why should somebody who's listening going, oh my God, I just finish up this conversation, why should they come and see PNB?
Well, I think the art form speaks to every individual, and I think people would be surprised by that. I don't want anyone to walk into the theater and think, I know what I'm going to see. You come see Air Twyla, and it's got a little bit of everything. It's going to connect to the individual, be it emotionally, be it physically, be it just the beat of the Alan Toussaint music. I mean, and also I think one of the nice things about PNB is that we do show such a variety of rep. So if that rep didn't fit an individual taste, the next rep probably will. So we want people like you that are that devoted.
That's not just me. It's you who's listening. So you're heading into season 41. And what are you, besides Twyla Tharp, what are you most excited about?
Well, I think I'm excited to see Giselle. We did an interesting staging a few years ago that I was very proud of. We worked from ancient texts and reconstructed original choreography with the help of Doug Fullington and Marion Smith. And I think at this point, dressing it up, putting our own sets and costumes on it. We had some decent costumes that we rented from the Houston Ballet, but this time it will really be...
So it's all new. It's PNB. Okay. Well, that...
Yeah, they're building all year. They're working away right now at it.
Well, I guess you've enticed me to come see it a third time. I think I've seen it twice already. Peter Boll is artistic director at Pacific Northwest Ballet, and he'll be here at least a few more years because he signed a new contract. The company season opens the last weekend in September at McCaw Hall, and maybe someday you'll have a little tiny theater to experiment with as well.
I would love that. That would be terrific.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
This is KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman. Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Charlie and Cindy Martin bought their first pinball machine just to have something to play after work. When that machine broke, they bought another one, and their collection eventually outgrew their house and became the Seattle Pinball Museum in Seattle's International District. Katie Sewell visited to learn more about the history of pinball and how the technology's changed through the years. Katie?
Yeah, pinball was largely banned from the late 1940s to the mid-1970s nationwide because it was considered to be a gambling game. Here's Charlie Martin.
So we've got a bingo machine downstairs that was typically a gambling device from the 1950s. They decided that gambling devices, particularly pinball machines, were evil and they were going to do away with them So Mayor LaGuardia from New York City rounded them all up in Prohibition-style raids and smashed them and dumped them into the East River.
It wasn't just New York. It was all over the country. People were getting rid of pinball or saying it's not okay for you to be doing this anymore.
It was all over the country, and up until, I believe, the 70s, in some areas in California, pinball was illegal.
Which makes, actually, the movie Tommy make a lot more sense.
Yes, it does. And pinball has always had, you know, kind of a edge to it. Pinball machines were played in pool halls and bingo parlors and taverns and back rooms and speakeasies. So there's always been a note of defiance towards society and the establishment.
Which is maybe why the Fonz is playing pinball in the opening credits of Happy Days.
Yeah, the Fonz was pretty good, and there's been lots of rebels in popular culture really lend an interesting air to the game of pinball.
And then I also read that to make it into a game of skill, they incorporated the tilt.
The tilt feature's original name was called Stool Pigeon, and it was devised by Harry Williams to detect people physically manipulating the game by lifting it up and moving it and shaking it, because they were games of chance or skill, and there was money on it. So Harry was watching some patrons play his game that had the Stool Pigeon device installed, and he overheard one of them say, "Be careful or you'll tilt it," and thought, that sounds a lot better than Stool Pigeon. I think I'll use that name.
Are the people who love pinball different than the people who love video games?
Definitely different, less cerebral and more physical. Video games, you sit on a couch and push some buttons. Pinball, you dance with a 250-pound machine.
Well, maybe let's walk around and you can show me some of the highlights from, as far as you're concerned.
This one is titled Pinball, and it's a pinball machine, and it's from 1977. Very simple artwork. It's a giant pinball rolling down the street, getting ready to squish some cars and the walkers-by. Yeah. And right next to it is the first one, by the way, same title, the solid-state machine. And it was right in 77 that all the pinball manufacturers changed from electromechanical to solid-state machines.
Can you explain the difference between those two different types of machines as far as how they're constructed?
The electromechanical one is basically all of the scoring is done with relays and contacts and trip banks and electromagnetic coils. The solid-state ones, all of that has been replaced by printed circuit boards and integrated circuit chips.
We're not seeing the numbers turning like a clock used to turn in the 80s.
Right. It's kind of like the difference between a abacus and a calculator.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one is all physical and the other one is all electronic. As pinball progresses, you really see the benefits of industrialization and electronic innovation through our military. You see printed circuit boards getting smaller and smaller. Trickle-down technology really is helping drive the innovation in the pinball machines, you know, in the last 20 years.
Now, who's the one in here that's making a bunch of noise?
The noise is a not very often seen game called Ali. It's a licensed by probably Muhammad Ali's manager at the time. One of the things that the manufacturers like to do was to have what they call attract mode. So if you're walking through an arcade, the machines would call out to you to try to get your attention to come over and get your quarters. Come visit me. Come play me. I need some quarters in my tummy.
And it even worked for the interview.
and it did.
Nice work.
Yeah.
Do you have a sense of what dictates the type of themes that are coming out over the years?
It really is a glimpse into what was happening in our culture at the times these machines were made. Like over here, we have a 1960 machine called Texan made by Gottlieb Company, and it's got a gentleman that looks very much like Ronald Reagan in a cowboy outfit, but he's smoking a cigarette. Mm-hmm. And right next to that, we have a 1962 Gottlieb called Liberty Bell, which is a patriotic theme.
Do you find that there are repeating themes?
It became apparent early on when we were collecting that these machines were designed primarily for the male audience, probably the most dominant reoccurring theme is voluptuous women depicted. I think it's changed, less sexually oriented and more diverse, time travel and sports and music.
You've talked a couple times about limited editions and how they only put out 500 of these. Mm-hmm. I guess I never considered that there were only so many of any of these machines. Are there any in particular that you're really searching for, the holy grail of pinball machine that you just can't seem to get your hands on?
The holy grail for me changes. A number of years ago, my holy grail for pinball was 1972 Bally Fireball Electromechanical, because I'd played it in the early 80s, and it really took me back to a more innocent time and just spending time with my friends, you know, drinking a little beer and playing, you know, 50-cent games or betting a dollar on the game. But part of the thrill is, you know, the chase and the hunt, and once you get it, then it's like, okay, what's next? Once you're bitten with the collector bug, it's pretty tough.
And it wouldn't be the cheapest thing to collect.
Well, pinball machines are definitely cost more than stamps, but it's cheaper than gold doubloons.
Is that how you know if you're really a pinball person, is if you actually have a machine that you're looking for all the time? I know I am. I have one I look in every single bar I go by to try to find one. I never...
What is it?
It's called Circus Voltaire.
Oh!
Well, that would be one we would like as well, so...
I'll be down here every day if you get it.
Really? Awesome. Well, we'll see if we can get one.
Circus Voltaire is a very, very good game, very fun, very highly sought after. So if anybody out there has one they'd like to sell to the Seattle Pinball Museum, please give us a call. We're very interested in talking to you.
I especially like it because of the audio. And we haven't really talked about that, but what they sound like. What do you think about the sound of these games?
Now, audio is... kind of an interesting topic because it's changed so much.
Before we end, I should have you fire some of them up so we can actually hear them.
This machine was made in 1969 by Bally and is called King Tut.
Okay, let's try another one.
The next machine is Circus, made by Zachariah Company from Milan, Italy, I believe, and it is from 1974.
Okay.
This is 1978 Bally, also Power Play. It's interesting how they can get different tones with different devices within the machine. It's bells, yeah. And actually, they make the sounds by different lengths of aluminum bars with electromagnets that shoot a rod up into it. And so the different length of the bar produces a different tone on the ring. This technically isn't a pinball. Rapid Fire, made by Bally in 1982.
Let's do one more.
When you start up Kiss, it plays a very recognizable song, but it's electronic tones, so just remember, it's not the real thing, but you get the idea. It definitely puts you in the right mood, because who doesn't want to rock and roll all night and party every day, right?
Right. That's Charlie Martin, the co-owner of the Seattle Pinball Museum, talking to me. The Pinball Museum features games from the 1960s to now, and all the machines are set to free play once you pay to get in.
Really?
Yeah.
So did, after you walked through with Charlie, did you sit around and play or stand around and play pinball?
Oh, yeah. We played some because all three of us are kind of pinball addicts. So it could have gone on for a long time, but I had to get back to work.
Oh, so that was work, Katie.
I know. That's the amazing thing. But it also began to feel irresponsible. So.
Okay. Well, it's just something that you'll store in your memory banks, as you, dear listeners, have many memories, most likely, of Weekday and the conversation with Ross Reynolds at 12 noon. And Katie's sort of hanging around right now because throughout this week, we've been talking to you, letting you know that starting in September, just as fall returns and the swallows return to Capistrano, you know, fall is a time where you get to rethink things, restart things, and it's a kind of a reboot time for KUOW programming.
Yeah, and it's often a time of change, and there will be some change to the KUOW programming come September 3rd. We are creating a new show. It's called The Record. It's going to be on from it's going to be on from noon to 2, and co-hosted by Marcy Silman, Steve Scher, and Ross Reynolds. They're combining the teams of Weekday and The Conversation together to create this new program. So as a result, Weekday and The Conversation will be going away and replaced by this new venture come September 3rd.
And at 9 in the morning, you're going to hear John Hockenberry and The Takeaway, and then a brand new show later in the morning called Here and Now from NPR. So there are going to be a mix of local news, national news, cultural news will be there. I've heard from a lot of people who worry about the arts. Don't worry. I'm going to be sitting here. The arts will never go away.
Yes.
Art outlives politics anyways, in my mind. But Katie will be going away.
I will be going away. Not because I'm not interested in working on the new show, and I will be for the next few weeks as it launches. But I and my husband accepted an opportunity to study in Rome for the next academic year. So I will be saying adieu, unfortunately, to all of you listeners, at least for the time being. And if you want to keep in touch with me, or add yourself to a list just in case I do anything amazingly cool while I'm over there from a radio perspective, email me at radiokatie@gmail.com.
And that's K-A-T-Y. And next 2 weeks, we're going to be bringing you a delve into the 20-year archive of Weekday. And we hope that you'll stay tuned for that. A lot of interesting sounds. And then join us September 3rd for The Record.
And now, the sound of the day.
So that was the sound of thunder, but you can hear a little bit of crunching in the foreground, and that's listener Trevor and a few of his friends hiking the Snow Lake Trail near Snoqualmie Pass in a thunderstorm. Luckily, Trevor didn't get hit by lightning, and luckily he had a field recorder with him to capture the sound of the storm. The lightning was close by. Trevor says they were really lucky. They made it back in one piece. No kidding. We're not asking you to pull out recorders in dangerous situations, but we do thank Trevor for bringing us the sound of thunder. What are you listening to? Record 30 seconds and send that sound to us, along with the story behind the sound. Email your audio file to weekday@kuow.org and include Sound of the Day in the subject line. Coming up in the next hour of Weekday, we're going to look back at 30 years of Northwest hip-hop, and maybe that thunder is the little bass line in the music. Who knows? Hope you'll stay with us.
It's 9:59, KUOW 94.9.
Join KUOW and the Seattle Indian.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.